I'm your host, Blake Collier, and on today's episode of 88 Names Podcast, Matt Ruff and I talk to Cory Doctorow, activist, journalist, and blogger, and author of Radicalized and Walk Away, about the state of technology and how it influences everything from economics to the environment. We also touch on how pop culture, like fiction, shapes the development of VR and AR tech, as well as tackling the issues of closed systems like Apple. This conversation dives deep on some philosophical and technical ideas, but remains deeply profound for anyone who wants to think on the impact of technology on the world. Last episode, we talked about Charles Wheatstone's stereoscope. Moving forward into the 19th century, we come across a more recognizable figure in the name of Thomas Edison, who at this point had already developed Edison Labs and had a team working with him, including a man by the name of William Dixon. It would be Dixon, under the guidance of Edison, in 1891, who would develop what would be known as the kinetoscope, the earliest moving picture device. However, as a trained historian, I am obligated to correct the history a bit at this point. As most of us know, history is seldom written by the losers, and so whole narratives are bulldozed in the name of celebrity or victory. In the late 1880s, a Frenchman by the name of Louis Le Prince would become the first person to shoot a moving picture via a single-lens camera in George Eastman's paper negative film. He would attempt to present the concept in America, but it would not be the case due to his sudden disappearance in September of 1890 when he boarded a train and was never seen again. This led to a spate of conspiracy theories, including murder at the order of Edison himself. We still to this day do not know what happened to Le Prince. But it is clear that the idea and execution belongs to him, even if Edison and Dixon improved and commodified it. The kinetoscope itself was a machine where a viewer, one at a time, would look into a single peephole as a perforated film taken at a high shutter speed would pass by the peephole's lens and would create an illusion of movement in the person's eye, similar to the old-fashioned flipbook. It would be this idea that would be the start of the motion picture camera and industry. This marks another movement in the human endeavor to inhabit another world that is similar but separate from our physical realities. Where Wheatstone delivered on the illusion of dimensional sight, Le Prince and Edison made movement of solid objects in a space possible, transporting us to whole new worlds. Yet, as significant as the kinetoscope is, it still only provides movement for two-dimensional objects while the stereoscope gave us a depth of field. The combination of three-dimensional depth and movement in a space remains just beyond our fingertips at this point in history. That will be left for the developments of the 20th century ahead of us.
GC Records proudly sponsors this podcast. To stream or download over 20 years of music, head to gcrecords.bandcamp.com.
Cory, do you mind giving us an introduction?
Sure. So I'm a science fiction novelist, and I've written about 20 books, some of them fiction, some nonfiction, some for young adults, some for adults. Probably best known for a young adult novel called Little Brother, and the third one of those is called Attack Surface, and it's coming out in October. I am a journalist, and I've written for many different outlets, and I'm an activist, career technology activist, working on issues related to fundamental justice, civil liberties, free speech, competition, and censorship and surveillance online, mostly through the Electronic Frontier Foundation, a venerable civil liberties group in San Francisco, where I'm a special advisor.
Wonderful. Wonderful. Well, I think Matt's going to start us off with the first question. So,
yeah. I figured we should probably start by talking about the fact that, like me, you wrote a novel about gold farming. Yours was called For the Win. I think it came out in 2010. And for people who don't know, gold farming is this thing where you play online video games and collect virtual loot like gold pieces and magic items and then sell them to other players for real money, which can be very lucrative. But there's a big class and culture divide between your protagonists and mine. In 88 Names, I'm sort of writing about the American dream version of the professional gamer, people who are, you know, typically middle class college students or college dropouts who, you know, have plenty of traditional career paths they could take, but have decided instead to try to monetize their hobby. For the Win is about more traditional gold farmers in places like China and India, who are really sweatshop workers. They typically work in internet cafes. They have bosses. They work in internet cafes on computers that they don't own. They work very long hours and get crap wages. So they're not the ones getting rich. And in your novel, they're trying to form a union, not just for gold farmers, but for workers in general. And the idea is that this will be an online union that they call the Weblies. That, you know, because it's in cyberspace, it's everywhere. So if you're a migrant worker moving from one country to another, you can join this union and take it with you, even as you cross international borders. So I was wondering if you'd talk about where this book came from and how realistic is it? Is this Weblies movement something that people are actually trying to do?
Yeah, it's kind of got a funny origin story. Many, many years ago, there was a super viral news story about a presentation at a GDC, the Game Developer Conference, which is now held in San Francisco every year. But I think back then it was still moving around from city to city. And this guy had come and he was known as kind of a grifter and a bit of a BS artist. But he gave this presentation where he said that he had been secretly paying people in Mexican border towns to play EverQuest and to amass virtual EverQuest gold that he was selling to lazy Americans. And it sparked this really intense online debate about whether, first of all, whether it was true and then what the ethics of it were and so on. And that inspired me to write a short story. And I have been for, I don't know, something like 20 years now, been writing short stories with the same titles as famous stories or similar titles to famous stories. It's kind of an exercise in thinking about art and appropriation. It started as a response to Ray Bradbury getting angry at Michael Moore for having this movie Fahrenheit 9/11.
Oh, God, because, I remember that.
Yeah, Ray Bradbury, it turns out, like, had many virtues, but his political acuity was a little thin, and he was a one-issue voter, and that issue was going to Mars. And since George Bush wanted to go to Mars, and since Laura Bush wanted to support libraries, which, you know, good for her, he was really upset that Michael Moore was tarnishing George W. Bush's reputation with his movie. And this is the guy, you know, who titled one book, I Sing the Body Electric, and, you know, yeah, just like all of these title appropriations. So anyway, I wrote a story called Enda's Game. Like Ender's Game.
Yeah.
and it was about a girl in England called Enda, who is a hardcore gamer. She gets involved in an all-girl gamer guild when this feminist games organizer does a school talk at her school. And while she's playing with an American friend, they start getting paid to go and kill these mysterious low-quality players who spend all of their time like crafting, doing really boring in-game tasks, crafting, fighting trash monsters, and so on. She doesn't know why she's getting paid to do it, but it's easy work and she's getting paid real money. And she's also struggling with her with obesity and with weight and with the exploitation and the exploitative nature of the ads that are targeted at her in the real world. And one of the things that the cash she's getting lets her do is go and buy the junk food her parents won't let her have. And so she's in this like very complicated situation. And then she learns from a union organizer who shows up in one of these sweatshops that she's been hired to be a Pinkerton and kill workers for rival sweatshop owners, for rival gold farmers. And this union organizer is trying to organize all of the players from all the different sweatshops to form a single union, and they need guards. And he tries to convince her that rather than being a Pinkerton, she should be muscle that defends the workers from this. Anyways, the story did really well. It was reprinted in the Year's Best American Science Fiction, which is hilarious because I'm a Canadian who is writing in Britain. And got reprinted in lots of other places too. And it convinced me to write a novel, which is For the Win. Now, For the Win also has an interesting story, which is that Charlie Strauss and I wanted to write a heist novel set in a video game. And, okay. You know, one of the things about collaborations is that each person in the collaboration does 75% of the work. And we realized that we didn't have time to collaborate. And so we decided we would each write two different novels from roughly the same outline. His was called Rule 34 and mine was called For the Win. And they are as different as two novels could possibly be. And yet they both come from the same idea. And there's some poetry there about like how ideas are cheap, execution is hard. And then hilariously, while I was on the road with that book, I was in Seattle and Neal Stephenson said, "Hey, I know you got to like bug out early tomorrow, but do you have time for breakfast? You can come by my place. I'll cook you some eggs before you go to the airport." So I did. And I said, "So what are you working on?" And he said, "Well, you ever heard of gold farming?"
Oh my God.
And I said, like, "You haven't read the book I'm touring, have you?" He's like, "Oh, I've been busy." So I told him the plot of my book and he was like, "Oh yeah, no, I'm working on a gold farming heist book as well right now." That was a book called Reamdy. And so this whole like weird moment in which all of these books came out that had the same plot. Some of it was because it was explicitly like me and Charlie working on the same thing. Some of it was just that when it's railroad time, you get railroads. And then First Second bought a graphic novel adaptation of Anda's Game for me, which Jen Wang undertook. She's brilliant. And she wrote this book with me called In Real Life, which is twice a New York Times bestseller and is a wildly popular middle grades book that, you know, Jen like really brought to life. And it's a cross between For the Win and In Real Life, really, and Anda's Game. So that book is like it's had a lot of different stages and phases.
Wow, that's fascinating.
this is one of the things that struck me reading it too, is that it was kind of funny that I felt like come the great socialist revolution when, you know, Bernie Sanders is swept into power, your protagonist and mine would probably end up on opposite sides of the barricades, because of course my guy thinks of himself, he's an independent business person, and his goal is to start a game company. And basically he wants to be Blizzard. He wants to become management. And so it's just sort of an interesting thing. But thinking about that made me think too, that even if you could get this online international labor movement going, I'm wondering if the culture in America would sort of still be something of a block to that, because at least in the tech sector, even people who are working jobs that really are kind of like sweatshop work or the closest you get to it in the high tech sector, stuff like coding. Like if I were going to try to unionize the gaming community in America, I would probably not go for game players. I would go after coders in places like Electronic Arts. But even there, I think you run up against this sort of libertarian ethos where it's like, yes, right now I'm being treated like crap and my bosses don't value me, but one day I too will be Elon Musk. And right. And when I do, I want Galt's Gulch to be waiting there for me, and the union's not going to help me. So is that's a real thing, right? That it's just very difficult generally in America, and particularly in the high tech sector, to get people to pull together for a union kind of thing, I think.
Well, you know, at the risk of having an okay boomer moment, I think that you're slightly behind on that one, because the last 2 years have been the years of the tech worker uprising. And that tech worker uprising has been accompanied by a tech lash of tech user uprisings. So 20,000 Googlers walked off the job last year. Microsoft is facing a revolt over its facial recognition and its work with ICE. Amazon just censured three employees who had the temerity to publicly comment in the Washington Post, which Jeff Bezos owns, on the deficiencies in Amazon's environmental policies. And it told HR told them that they could be fired for doing that. And instead of quietly taking their note from HR and keeping their heads down, they published that note. And a week later, 350 Amazon engineers published their own public denunciations of Amazon's environmental policies. And at the same time, YouTubers are unionizing in Germany. IG Metall, which is it's the most metal union ever. They're a big sheet metal workers union, has organized YouTubers who are demanding that Google like not demonetize them without a right of appeal.
Interesting.
That they like, you know, so like, and Twitch streamers are even angrier. And then you add into that all of the Blizzard gamers who got kicked off of Blizzard at a Blizzard tournaments for holding up Hong Kong solidarity signs. And I actually think that your guy will be like part of a waning tendency.
Yeah, and it's entirely possible. I mean, because I'm, of course, I've been in a little room talking to myself for the last 2 years. I did catch the Blizzard thing because that was all over Twitch and the streamers I follow. But I also had wondered whether the ascendancy of Donald Trump might have changed the logic of a lot of this stuff too. So that's interesting.
It's Trump and it's climate, right? Mm-hmm. So this is the other thing that's happened is that a lot of libertarians have run up, like libertarians who were libertarians in good faith, right? Who were not libertarians because they just didn't want anyone to tell them what to do because they wanted to be able to do whatever they wanted without having to care about anyone else. But they'd spun up some, you know, ideological justification for why that was also Pareto optimal. But actual, actual like thoughtful people who, you know, really thought that it was a path to the greatest prosperity have watched how the libertarian movement addressed climate change. So, you know, when climate change first became a well understood phenomenon, there were a lot of free market types who took ideas from Ronald Coase for things like cap and trade, so tradable credits, which had worked for eliminating acid rain. And they said, this is how we'll deal with climate change, right? And the people who were alarmed about climate change said, you know, it sounds to us like you're just trying to put off the inevitable here. You know that no one's going to agree with that. You know that what we actually want is limits on CO2 emissions. And so like, this is your like, well, if you offered us this, we would take it. But since you're not offering it, we're not going to do anything because you want to intervene in markets. And then, you know, lo and behold, along comes cap and trade schemes. And the very same people that said, well, if there was cap and trade, we'd do it, said, oh, we're not going to do it because climate change is a hoax, right? And then 20 years later, everything is on fire. And right. A ton of libertarians have declared themselves to be what they call state capacity libertarians. So the actual, like, the core of the libertarian movement has been siphoned off. Like the Cato Institute is you know, begging for money. Most of those people have become Trumpers. They've discovered a great love of closed borders and trade wars. It provided that they get $1 trillion in tax cuts at the same time. But the people who are kind of intellectually honest with themselves have become this weird chimera called a state capacity libertarian, which is like libertarianism for everything except climate change, or for that we'll need big governments to do stuff. And, you know, it's a very weird hybrid for them to have arrived at. They're so close to figuring it out, you know?
It's almost like Trump has almost forced those kind of weird amalgamations of political groups and interests.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, what exactly captured your interest with Matt's book, and where did you find intersections with your own interests and specialties within that book?
Well, you know, the way that I came to write my books was because I live with a gamer. So my wife played Quake for England. She was like, before esports were esports, she was a globally ranked esports champion. And then she ran the video game practice for Channel 4 and the BBC in the UK, and kind of oversaw their video game production, public interest video game production, while playing in these like hardcore guilds with, you know, economists and all these other kind of games academics and games designers. And so I'm surrounded by hardcore gamers. And now my wife's job is that she runs a thing at Disney called Studio Lab, which is like their advanced storytelling lab, which does all kinds of amazing things, including VR, AR, virtual production, and so on. So I'm not a VR person at all. I actually am so astigmatic that I can't converge VR readily, and I get horrible headaches from it. I pay extra to see movies that aren't in 3D.
Yeah.
And right. And you're the same. Yeah. And so, but I am, as with video games, I am peripheral to all of this stuff. And there's something very interesting about being next to something without being in it. It's a very Canadian thing to be, you know. I've got to radicalize my last book. It's up for the Canadian National Book Prize, the Canada Reads Prize. And I was just up in Toronto doing a bunch of media for it. And they asked me, like, what is it about being a Canadian? Like, what is it about this book that helps Canadians understand Canada? And I said, well, you can't understand Canada unless you understand Canada's relationship to America. So much of Canada is defined in terms of its differences and similarities to America. This is why Canadians are like the funniest American comedians, right?
Yeah.
For the same reason that the unpopular kid knows who's who in all the cliques, because you've got to stand on the edge of the playground and make sure you don't get walloped. And to do that, you have to have these like keen social antennae that are monitoring what's going on with everything else. So, you know, in terms of games in VR, by not having a dog in the fight, but by being at the fight every day,
yeah,
I feel like I have an opinion that is, you know, a little colder and more distant and a little more oriented around like a wider perspective than the actual experience of playing the games, and more like how the games affect the world.
Yeah, that makes sense. That makes complete sense.
I knew your wife was a gamer, and I had wondered whether you were, because it seems to me you are way too productive to be a hardcore gamer. I can think nothing of, well, I'll spend the day just farting around in Hearthstone if I feel like it. And right. I will often feel like it when I'm not on a deadline. So I had a feeling you probably had played some games, but had not spent amounts of time.
And my wife is in the top 3% of worldwide Hearthstone players as well.
Oh, wow.
Oh, wow.
Man,
yeah, I like to brag on her.
Yeah, that's good.
It's funny, you know, when I was out on tour with For the Win, I did, it was either ALA or BEA in New York, and they do this, the young adult breakfast. It must have been BEA. So all the young adult booksellers in America are in a giant ballroom, and they have three YA authors and then a celebrity YA author, and each of you presents your book. And then afterwards you do a mass signing, and all the young adult booksellers get your book. And our celebrity was Sarah Ferguson, the Duchess of York, who writes these just abominable children's books about how everything is terrible. Like, you should be afraid of strangers, and you should be afraid of drugs, and you should be afraid of cyberbullying. And she had just literally the day before been caught on a hidden camera and had it published, meeting with a pretend Arab sheikh who is actually an undercover journalist for the Telegraph. They call him the fake sheikh. Oh, who had offered her money to introduce him to her husband, the prince. And she had said for $250,000, she would sell time with the prince. And so we got to our green room for this thing, and they wouldn't let us in because they thought we were paparazzi who were there to stalk her. And she showed up 20 minutes late in a phalanx of burly armed guards on a mobile phone, screaming like, I couldn't, how could you? You know better. And like weeping. And then she clicked her phone shut, wiped her eyes, took a deep breath and said, hello, I'm Sarah. It's very nice to meet you. And then she asked us about our books. And I told her about my book about video games. And she said, so you think video games are good?
Oh, God.
That was awesome. Oh, God. Never have I wanted a guillotine more.
I love the royal family.
Derooted is a proud sponsor of the 88 Names podcast. Derooted, immersive experiences and interactive activations helping brands connect globally. Find case studies and more at derooted.com.
So you write often about post-scarcity economics. If you don't mind doing a little off-the-cuff prophesying or forecasting for us, how do you see technology like virtual reality affecting those avenues of economics, especially in the post-automation realm of labor?
So I tell you, I think that I've had a transformation in my view on post-scarcity.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm skeptical of accounts of automation and scarcity, and it comes down to climate change.
Okay.
So say it turns out to be right that we can automate away using some combination of VR, robotics, whatever, AI, ML, we can automate away 70% of the labor done today. every person whose job is automated away is needed to fill sandbags, move entire cities, build seawalls, tend to people who are, refugees because they've lost their homes, mm-hmm. and deal with the pandemics that are going to come for the next 300 years.
Wow.
Right. But like, you know, Keynes had this thing that, you know, if you want to stimulate the economy, you could pay half the out of work workers to dig holes and the other half to fill them in. Well, you know, we subsidized our ancestors for 200 years to dig carbon out of the ground. We're going to have to subsidize our descendants for 300 years to put it back in.
Man, that's insane.
And so, you know, like computers make some things not scarce, but we have a demand on our resources and time that computers that any weight that computers takes off our shoulders and any coordinative power that computers give us, you know, like the thing that I do think is going to happen is the amount of institutional overhead needed to accomplish ambitious things will continue to fall, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you know, today we build, you know, encyclopedias and operating systems the way that, you know, ants build hills, you know, like with very little top-down administrative overhead. You know, there's some, but like compared to, you know, the team that made OS 360 for the IBM 360 or Windows or OS 10, you know, the Linux operating system is a very diffused group of people. And it's also the most successful operating system by wide latitude of any of them. What that means is that we're going to be able to do really ambitious things that are relatively spontaneous and fluid and flexible. And so that might feel like the end of scarcity. Like we may have things like certain heavy industry may only take place when there is enough renewable energy local to a factory that the factory can run without tapping into the base load, where it's just using the variable load. And then the minute the sun goes behind a cloud, everyone goes and has a party and they turn on a factory somewhere else. And the people who live near that stop having a party and go work in the factory. Wow. Right? Google already has data centers that work like this. There's a data center in Belgium that has no chillers. And that's the major power consumption element in a data center. And because of the way Google's load balancing and distributed file systems work, that data center literally only runs when it's cold enough to run outside. Wow. They don't need a chiller. The rest of the time, they just turn it off.
So would you say that ultimately, if we get to this point where the remainder of the labor needed was for, like you said, sandbags and basically rebuilding towns and things like that, would it be? Would you say that it would cycle back around to manual labor and agricultural labor, basically, going back to the quote unquote good times back when we were working the land and things like that. So what would you say? It's almost like a cycle or
I think the thing that it will share in common with it. So like the dream of industrial capital since the Industrial Revolution has been to de-skill labor by decomposing complex tasks into simple tasks that don't require a lot of training, largely so that workers can be made interchangeable, and that reduces the ability of workers to exert pressure to increase wages because they can be easily replaced, but also for flexibility, right? Also so that you can move a worker from one part of a project to another without having to do a lot of expensive retraining. And what I think we will have is a very, very high tech, manufacturing and agricultural and transport and logistics sectors, where the human labor that's needed will be some combination of like last mile, exercising judgment, sanity checking algorithms, doing the stuff that they like while you wait for the robots to show up. If it's like filling sandbags while you wait for the giant earth moving machine to be requisitioned and moved over so that humans don't have to fill the sandbags. And so I think that you'll see a flexibility that way. Mm-hmm. Like imagine, you know, and this is science fiction's coolest move, is imagining existing economic and social arrangements with a very different context. So, you know, there's this book by Lee Phillips called The People's Republic of Walmart that points out that you know, in the 20s, there was this like debate among the Austrian economists that really gave rise to the free market Austrian movement, you know, von Mises and von Hayek, mm-hmm. where they proved mathematically that you could never build a computer big enough to manage a large industrial economy, right? Mm-hmm. But now, like, the internal economies of the largest employers on Earth, like the Pentagon, Walmart, Amazon, you know, the People's Liberation Army, they're all on a scale comparable to the Soviet Union in 1989, mm-hmm. and they don't use markets for allocation, right? Yeah. Party Secretary Bezos instructs the commissars on how to affect the five-year plan.
Yeah.
And, you know, all of the Amazon workers are directed according to it, from the engineers all the way down to the kulaks packing boxes in the warehouses, right? So, like, the question then becomes, like, once we've shown that you can run a thing on the scale of, you know, the Soviet Union as a command economy that is very efficient and delivers things people want, the question then becomes, like, what do we do? Because markets are the only things we have, but, like, when do we want to use markets? And, you know, if markets become just another tool and they lose their moral force, then it really opens up the possibility space, and we'll have mixed allocation. You know, there's this Texas economist who does a YouTube channel called The Cowboy Economist, and he says, you know, carpenters don't attach moral weight to the hammer. They don't say, you know, I'm a hammer man and I'm not going to use a screwdriver. No way, no how. Right. Yeah. And so mm-hmm. if markets are just a tool, the idea that we wouldn't use central planning when it makes sense to use central planning and markets when it makes sense to use markets becomes as weird as the idea that we wouldn't use hammers or that we wouldn't use screwdrivers to put in a screw.
That makes sense.
So my next question, you recently retweeted a 10-year-old Boing Boing article about why you won't buy an iPad and why you don't think other people should either. And
yeah.
The gist of which is that buying into Apple's ecosystem is kind of a devil's bargain. And one aspect of this is what you call the Walmartization of the software channel, where Apple gets to control what sorts of apps you can buy and on what terms, and which is a limitation of both buyers and sellers, obviously. And there was kind of I got into something like this. There's a scene in 88 Names where my protagonist, John Chu, is sort of spitballing with his girlfriend about what kind of game they would want to make if they were going to make, you know, what kind of role-playing game they would work on ideally. And she comes up with this idea for combining a traditional MMO, but then somehow including cyber sex. And John Chu is kind of horrified by this idea for a number of reasons, but one of which is that if you slap an adults-only rating on a game, it makes everything more difficult, that it's harder to get funding. There are companies that simply won't do business with you. And obviously you cannot sell sexually explicit games in the Apple Store or at Walmart for that matter. And that's a kind of sales restriction or taboo that I think most consumers don't really have a problem with. But of course, there's nothing to stop Apple or Walmart from quietly setting up taboos against other kinds of products. Like, you know, we won't sell anything that offends the Chinese government. We won't mm-hmm. sell anything that gets this or that pressure group mad at us. And
well, notoriously, Apple wouldn't allow anyone to list an app that told you when a U.S. drone hit a civilian.
Oh, really?
Wow. Yeah.
I was wondering
they wouldn't allow you to have a dictionary that had swear words in it, like an actual English dictionary that had swear words in it.
It's interesting because I was thinking the only sexually explicit material that you might conceivably get on the Apple Store would be a prose novel. They're not gonna you know, cut that out. But so yeah, I was wondering though, it creates this interesting thing where obviously for stuff like porn, there's enough of a market demand that it might be worth your while to create a separate distribution channel, that there's enough profit to be had that it's worth going to the trouble. But with other items that, you know, certain people might not want you to have, it might be a useful thing to be able to access, but at the same time, there might not be enough value added to sell it or to try to sell it if you can't sell it through a more regular store. And that raises this problem. I guess Amazon is another case where if Amazon doesn't want to sell something, that really can impact people's ability to get hold of it. And so it creates this real weird power within the market if you have a wide enough market share. And I gather this would always have been a problem, but now the internet just allows markets to be so much broader that it gives you a lot more control, as long as you don't piss off the customers enough that they realize, wait a minute, there's a whole bunch of stuff we can't get now, and we need a store that will sell that to us. And so I was wondering, you know, how worried should people be about this, and what thoughts you might have on that?
Yeah. So I think that there's a dimension that you're missing, actually, in that analysis. It's a very good analysis, but there's one other thing that is the elephant in the room, which is that in 1998, Bill Clinton signed the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. And Section 1201 of the DMCA makes it a felony to bypass a copyright lock like the one that locks your phone to Apple's App Store. And so it's not just that, it's not just Walmartization in the sense that, like, if you live in Seattle or LA where I live, you might think of Walmart as like the 600-pound gorilla that, you know, is the easiest place to get to and has the most stuff, and therefore their choices have this incredible salience. It's more like Walmartization in small town America, where after Walmart moves in, there's no other stores, right? Like, if you have an iPhone, you don't get to say, well, Apple's phone is great, but the policies for the App Store don't suit me. I want to get a dictionary with dirty words in it, or find it about US drone strikes, or, you know, the Apple bookstore has banned books that have links to Amazon in them. And so, you know, you like, so if you've written a book like How to Succeed on the Web, and it has links to how to set up an Amazon affiliate account, that book won't play in the Apple bookstore. And so, you know, you have these content-based restrictions and you can't escape them, right? You're locked into those content-based restrictions. And not in just a little way, right? It's a felony punishable by a 5-year prison sentence and a $500,000 fine to bypass those locks. And, you know, Apple has been extremely unwilling to allow you to use the platform, to criticize the platform, to talk about the platform. And that's, I think, the other major risk here. And it creates all these like hazardous situations. So you alluded to the Chinese government. Apple first eliminated all working VPNs from their Chinese app store and caved to the Chinese government, so that Chinese dissidents can only communicate in ways that the Chinese government can see and take reprisals against them for. And this is, you know, at a time in which, like, international tribunals are upholding claims that the Chinese state is harvesting organs from imprisoned religious minorities, like members of Falun Gong, who've been imprisoned for their religious faith. So they're being like killed and rendered for parts. Jeez. And so, you know, there's a good reason that people in China might want to use a VPN that the government there can't spy on. More recently, you know, they yanked an app that Hong Kong protesters were using to figure out where the murderous, violent, out of control cops were during the pro-democracy protests. And the thing is that you can't say, okay, well, Apple won't distribute this, therefore I'll distribute something else. Apple's argument is, well, we have to comply with the government's regulation. The thing is that as soon as you put that gun on the mantelpiece, as soon as you say, if you regulate us, then people won't be able to see anything you ban us from distributing, you should expect to have government show up and say, okay, I've got a laundry list of things you're not allowed to carry anymore. You know, more close to home, a couple of years ago, the U.S. government passed a law called SESTA-FOSTA that was posed as an anti-sex trafficking app, but what it does, or law rather, but what it does is it makes platforms liable if there is any sex trafficking on the site, even if they act expeditiously to remove it and to police it as soon as they know that it exists. And so what that did was it shut down Craigslist and Backpage and a bunch of other things. One of the things that it did was it caused Apple to remove the Tumblr app from the App Store because Tumblr was a place where people who had particularly alternative sexuality, LGBTQA, women-centric sexuality, porn, and so on, that those people used Tumblr to communicate with one another. And because Tumblr couldn't be sure, because Apple couldn't be sure, they took the Tumblr app out of the App Store. Well, Tumblr immediately just lost its users. as a result, they decided that they would just create this machine learning based nudity filter that would remove all nudity. And, you know, if you've been paying attention, you know, it's a catastrophic failure.
Yeah.
And that it has been, you know, not just like an censorship apocalypse for, you know, alternative sexuality and positive depictions of alternative sexuality, but also that it has, you know, snuffed out all kinds of things that aren't sexual in nature. You know, there's I have a Tumblr post that has a picture of some ductwork that forks suggestively that gets removed from the Tumblr store. Like, it gets removed from my Tumblr feed, like on the reg, like about once a month, I get a message saying, you know, nudity has been discovered in your feed and we have taken action to block it. So, you know, it has all these knock-on effects, this decision to put you to once you take up the censor's pen and assert your right to wield it, people will demand that you wield it in order to solve their problems. And so one of the best ways to not be called upon to censor is to divest yourself of the ability to do so.
Yeah.
And that the only way to do that is to have an open ecosystem. Mm-hmm. I guess.
Yeah.
How you know, there's yeah. all kinds of these things. It's you know, economists call it the Ulysses Pact, right? You know, Ulysses lashes himself to the mast before sailing into the siren infested waters, right, so that he isn't tempted to jump into the sea. You can pre-commit to certain courses of action by embedding it in your hardware, your software, your business model, so that the state can come and demand things of you, but it doesn't matter. So, for example, you know, there's now a thing called certificate transparency, where every time your browser receives a security certificate, it makes a little hash of it and uploads it to a bunch of servers that have these append-only logs. And then if any of the certificate authorities in the world has a government come to them and say, can you please make some undetectable Google certificates so that we can spy on people's Google traffic, the people who run that certificate authority can say, of course, if you order me to do it, I'm going to do it. You know, I'm not going to go to jail over this. But you need to know that within an hour, Google will know that I did that. Within a day, all the browsers will have removed the certificate authority from the root of trust, and everyone will know that it's happened. So you never, so like by pre-committing, right, by like building this into the infrastructure of browsers, you forestall the possibility that anyone will ask you to commit shenanigans.
Wow.
That's an interesting counterplan against it. Yeah.
So how does fiction, including 88 Names and For the Win, shape the development and use of technology, including virtual reality, both among developers of technology and in the popular general consciousness?
Well, certainly, you know, fiction gives us like a vocabulary for talking about technology. And you think about Bill Gibson's cyberspace, or the fact that everyone who was hired at Second Life back in the day was given a copy of Snow Crash and said, you know, read this over the weekend. You start Monday. It's our business plan. You know,
that's awesome.
Hilarious, right? Like, I'm sorry, cyberpunk is a warning, not a suggestion. But you know, there is that, right? Like it gives us the functional vocabulary for thinking and talking and criticizing. I have a novella in the new collection in Radicalized called Unauthorized Bread about
toasters. It's a great story.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, so it's about toasters that only let you toast manufacturer-approved bread in the same way the App Store.
Which is hilarious. Anyway. Yeah.
Yeah. But like, what's the difference, right, between Apple saying you can only run authorized apps and, you know, like every argument Apple makes about apps you can make about like dishes and dishwashers or toasters and toast, right? Like, you know, how can we keep you safe if we can't control your apps? How can we stop you from starting a house fire if we can't approve which bread is going in there? You know, how can we guarantee your user experience if we can't control your apps? Well, how can we make sure your bread is toasty and has exactly the right crumb if we can't control which bread you put in, and so on and so on and so on? How could we afford to sell you a phone at this price if we couldn't get a little piece of the apps? Well, how could we afford to sell you this toaster at this price if we couldn't get a little piece of the bread? You know, all of those arguments carry over one to one. And so that story, that kind of reductio ad absurdum, which then, you know, widens out into a wider lens on technology and power, has become a vocabulary that people are already using to talk about other things in the news. So, you know, when HP says, you don't own the ink in your printer, you only rent it. And if you stop paying a subscription, the ink will stop working, even though you bought it. Yeah. Right. That then people go, oh, this is like unauthorized bread. Or when Abbott Labs remotely shuts down third-party apps that read data out of their glucose monitors that are used by people with diabetes, because they want to make sure that you only connect their glucose monitor to their insulin pump and not to a third-party insulin pump, then, you know, people go, oh my God, you know, they turn people into human inkjet printers. It's just like an authorized bread. And so, you know, that's the most valuable thing it can do. It can inspire people and it can give them the critical vocabulary for telling the stories. Yeah.
One technological divide that I don't really talk about in 88 Names, but that fascinates me, is the distinction between full bore virtual reality, where everything you see in your VR goggles is computer generated, and augmented reality, where you see the real world around you, but enhanced with computer graphics and overlays. Mm-hmm. And do you have any thoughts about whether, you know, VR, AR is more likely to be broadly adopted? I mean, it's early days for both, and I can certainly see useful specialized applications for both, but I'm wondering if you think one of them is more likely to take off and become the default first choice of people who want to mess around with some sort of augmented reality or virtual reality.
Well, I think that there is, like, just as a practical matter, there is a limit to how much time people are going to spend with a brick on their face.
Yeah.
Right. So, you know, that is obviously, like, one of the major considerations whenever we talk about the future of VR. AR is really interesting because of its promise and peril. So, you know, the thing that everyone has been hoping for with computers since the first computers is that they will be a kind of ubiquitous and inconspicuous decision support system, right? That, like, just at the moment that you're making a choice, you know, the computer comes in and nudges you a bit. Just as you're fishing for someone's name, you get a quiet voice in your ear that says, no, that's Matt Ruff, you know? And so, that's what we've all been hoping for. And we have made computers more and more personal. We put them in phones and we've put them in our pockets, obviously. And rather than allowing us to be more present, which is what decision support nominally delivers, they have made us significantly less present overall. There mm-hmm. are moments in which they make us more present, but by and large, they make us less present. And so while a brick on your face does in fact generally preclude walking down the street like a mobile phone zombie, you know, although God, who knows, right? Maybe there'll be a pass through, right? Maybe there'll be people running around with bricks on their faces who are, you know, like getting a real time feed and trying to navigate, you know, the sidewalks of the streets, God help us, you know, riding bird scooters with bricks on their faces, you know, having some gamified, I'm playing Real World Joust. It's a retro Ernie Klein style arcade experience or something, you know, like, and like in traffic, you know, without a helmet.
They've already got the one that I always think of is there's apparently a jogging program that you can hear zombies chasing you.
Oh yeah, Zombies Run. I know the folks who made that. They're British. Yeah,
of course you do.
But that's binaural. Yeah, no, they worked with my wife at Channel 4. No, that's binaural. And you're right. You know, it doesn't have that pass through. And you know, we do get the closest that we come to having a shared environment is that is having one headphone in. Right. Mm-hmm. Where, you know, you're listening to a podcast and you're walking down the street, or you're, you know, listening to your jam and you're running around or whatever. Right. That's about as close as we come. Mostly, though, what we do is we get really distracted. And the thing about AR is that it's going to be a lot easier to ride a bird scooter while wearing AR goggles, or, you know, mm-hmm. run down the street or walk down the street or drive a car or show up for school. And there'll be a lot more, like, legitimate applications, right? Like, you know, make a video of what the teacher is telling me now so that I can return to it later, or, you know, add to the Blackboard, you know, last night's homework so that I can see whether or not I did it right, or whatever it is. Right. And, it's going to be really hard to resist the temptation to alt-tab to the AR frame that is like a YouTube video of a guy putting a lemon up his nose. And, you know, we're going to be a nation of people watching other people put lemons in their noses as we walk down the street. in a way that like transcends the phone zombie phenomenon with AR, assuming AR is ever perfected, right? Assuming we ever get a functional AR system.
And yeah, they still got some way to go with that, I know, but that's interesting. Yeah, that would be my intuition as well, is that that is one of the real limitations of VR, besides currently being tethered to a workhorse computer and the weight, is that even if you lighten it, you still, there is this problem of slamming into physical objects that you can't see.
Yeah.
Faster yeah. than the Guardian system can warn you that you're headed for a wall.
Yeah. You know, I have a fancy car that I got as a loaner for a year. I did a consulting gig for a car manufacturer that was, whoops, sorry, there's a siren going good. By here. Speaking of cars. I had this fancy car that I got as part of compensation for a consulting gig I did for a car manufacturer. And it has like 10 million in-car systems, including like 16 cameras and radar and all kinds of stuff. And there were a couple of times where it's really helped. We have a very tricky reverse out of our driveway where we can't really see down one side. And sometimes kids ride their bicycles from that direction in the wrong way, contra traffic behind the car as we're reversing out and trying not to get clobbered by cars coming the other way. And twice now the car has braked itself. You know, not they weren't quite behind the car at that point, but they were headed for the car, and the car was smart enough to go, oh, there's a cyclist coming, and like hit the brakes. Speaking as a former cyclist, you know, like I was very, very glad of that. But most of the things that the car does are profoundly distracting. Like if I die driving this car, it will be because I was trying to find the thing on the touchscreen to make the other thing on the touchscreen go away so that I could see the third thing on the touchscreen that I needed in order to make the car work.
Is there or will there ever be a point where the chasm between virtual reality and what we consider metaphysical reality will be transcended?
Like, will people found religions based on VR? Yeah, or?
Like, will it become almost like in Matt's novel, like a whole, you pretty much spend like 95 to 100% of your life online through VR or virtual or augmented reality or virtual reality.
Or at least you do if you have the kind of slacker lifestyle where you can afford to do that.
Exactly.
Yeah, sure. I mean, yes. Well, we spend a lot of time looking at screens. Totally.
Exactly.
That feels pretty like a pretty easy one. You know, and some of it will be VR and some of it won't be. I think that VR is going to run up against this problem that there are a lot of people who are going to struggle like optically with it.
Yeah.
And the brick on the face problem and so on. But, you know, well, did you say physical reality or metaphysical reality?
Like metaphysical reality.
Okay. Yeah. So like definitely people will have a metaphysics of computers, right? Yeah. Like, you know, they already do. And it's only going to, you know, Slender Man was like, you know, the 0.96 beta version of this thing, but you'll have full bore religions based on VR as a form of worship for sure.
Nice.
You know, like if people can organize like syncretic modern religions around peyote or whatever, they'll definitely organize them. You know, I'm not talking about traditional indigenous faiths. I'm talking about like, you know, white people from cities being like, hey, I read some Carlos Castaneda novels and I got these cactus buttons and now I've got a faith, you know?
That makes sense. That
will definitely happen with VR too. And probably, you know, while taking ayahuasca or whatever.
Beautiful. And I would imagine that some of that is largely, especially right now, based on your ability, like your class, basically, which is where, you know, America's never dealt with the issue of class very well and its historical appraisal of itself. And so we're the grand middle class, but really the rich are getting richer and the poor are getting poorer. So it really is a matter of money in that sense. Who can actually afford the technology and who can afford, like Matt said, to spend their whole life online.
Well, I think that whatever that you know, the big question is what's going to happen in the future with China between pandemics and trade wars and democratization movements. It's not, I think that it's like, it's really anyone's guess.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess the good final question would be, I know your short story collection Radicalize is coming out in paperback on March 3rd, I think. And then you had mentioned you have another book coming out in October. So what's next for you after that? What are you going to work on next?
Well, so there's a whole bunch. There's more books coming out this year, actually. So there's Posey the Monster Slayer, which is a picture book that First Second is publishing that comes out on July the 14th. And I'll be at Comic-Con with that and stuff. And then there's a reissue of Little Brother and Homeland in one volume with an introduction. If I tell you who it's by, can you bleep it? Because it's under embargo.
Yeah, we sure can.
With an introduction by.
Oh, wow.
Oh, my goodness.
He just turned in. And it's amazing. And then I have just finished the outline for my next novel, which is called The Lost Cause. And it's a novel set after a successful Green New Deal. It's set here in Burbank, where I live. And it's about truth and reconciliation with, militiamen, corporate apologists and denialists who are on the wrong side of the GND and who, you know, believe that they're living in a hellscape, even though it's the first time in 100 years that a generation has grown up not afraid of the future. And so while everyone else is like wiping their brow and going, wow, we met that crisis and we will be able to overcome it, they're like, oh my God, the crisis just got worse. and how we deal with those people. You know, what do you do when there's militiamen who like scale the roof of the local high school with ball peen hammers to smash the solar panels to end the conspiracy to take America off of the fossil fuels that made it great?
Wow.
And how do you manage those people? And so that's underway now. And I just got commissioned to write a short story set in that world by MIT Tech Review. So I'm working on that like literally today when we get off the call, I'm starting work on that. And I often do this when I'm working on a novel. I'll write a bunch of short stories set in kind of the backstory of the world or thematically linked to it. Did this with Walkaway. I wrote a story called The Man Who Sold the Moon, another one of those famous title stories that, you know, went on, won the Sturgeon Award and got reprinted a bunch of places. And so, yeah, I'm doing that now, writing that little short story. And I've got a book length essay, like a 37,000 word essay coming out soon, I believe soon, on Motherboard, which is one of Vice's verticals. And it's about an alternative to Shoshana Zuboff's surveillance capitalism hypothesis, which is, you know, she sort of feels that like big tech has invented a mind control ray using machine learning. And I think that all they've done is just become monopolists, and it's giving them way too much credit to think that the reason they dominate their sector is because machine learning works really well for influencing people. And it's just that they like bought or destroyed everyone who might compete with them.
Man.
So to reiterate, you are way too productive to be a hardcore gamer. And
I'm barely a reader at this point. I wish I had more time to read. I always make time for your books. But
well, thank you, man. You know, I really appreciate it. And thank you for making time for us today.
Yes.
Yeah.
And
yeah, well, my pleasure.
That is it for this episode of 88 Names Podcast. We will be back next Friday with a new episode. If you like the podcast, go to Apple Podcasts and give us a rating and a review, which will help us get more listeners. Remember to check back at the podcast site at riseupdaily.com/88namespodcast for the podcast introduction and upcoming written interviews and articles. We would like to thank Threaded Zebra Agency, AltSpace VR, Drooted, and Creative Mornings for their support and work on this podcast. We will see you soon.